This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
If you start saying that every time someone says something which someone else finds offensive that it is racist, it seems to me you blur the distinction between racially motivated hatred, racism, and frankly just offensive free speech, which oddly enough, of course, was the subject of a lot of debate around the around those terrible attacks on Je Suis Charlie. That is, I accept, a matter of judgment and indeed of opinion, but my view is that if we're going to pick our way through this time of great tension in exactly the same way that we need to protect Niran's right, unqualified right, to take her children to school, to do so without fear, to have her children display their identity with pride and not with fear, we also, because it's part and parcel of the same thing of being a free, liberal society, we also need to, even when it's unpopular or controversial, draw the line between people who say offensive things and people who say racist things. Where they say racist things, that we've got to come down on them like a ton of bricks. Where
well,
they
who's going to judge what's offensive and what's racist?
Well, in terms of, as Niran said, the law is very clear in terms of when, you know, violence is racially motivated or driven by hatred. There are occasions where Liberal Democrats have said things, and indeed MPs of other parties, which seems to me to cross the line, and then there are consequences. On that particular instance, saying what he did about the presence of the Israeli Prime Minister in Paris, I thought it was wrong. It was insensitive. I didn't think it was racist.
All right. A couple of emails. This Graham in Bushy. Is it right that the former prisoner Chris Huhne still has a pass to get him into the House of Commons? He's no longer an MP.
Look, the rules are that you can, as an ex-MP, you can get this pass unless you've been in prison for more than 12 months. And he was in prison for, 8 months?
Yes.
So, look, you know, he's... the rules are the rules, and I honestly think we can't start constantly rewriting the rules because people may dislike or like this or that individual.
Okay, so you're happy with that?
Yeah, well, he's abiding by the rules.
Okay, Teddy in Kent, how satisfied are you the measures brought in by Theresa May will protect journalists from unnecessary police snooping?
I think we've made real progress. Fine, I've been urging Theresa May for some months now to make sure that when the police want to have access to the confidential, privileged information that journalists have, which is essential for them to do their job, which in turn is essential to keep people in power on their toes and to uncover
news desks, phone contacts, and political editors.
I've always believed that the police should have that power, but that it should be subject to a judicial decision, judicial discretion. And thankfully now the Information Commissioner published a report, I think it was yesterday, saying exactly the same thing, and we're now going to act on that as a government. I'm delighted, because I've for a long time been arguing that we should make this change, because I want to strike the right balance between giving the police the powers they need, sometimes to go after privileged, even confidential information, but not do so randomly, and certainly not to do so in a way which has a chilling effect on our traditions of freedom of expression.
So when will this actually be? Can we get this done?
We're hoping to pass I need to double-check, because this is all quite a fast-moving thing.
The serious crime bill.
Yes, serious crime bill. We're hoping to pass that amendment.
How much coalition support is there for this?
So now, my point was, I've been arguing this for some time. I think, I need to double check, but I think the Conservatives now have come to the same view, which is good, because it means it'll happen.
Let's get to another call. Where should we go?
To John in Devon. Hello, John.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yes, it's a nice morning down here. Lovely sunny. Basically, my question to you is, what are your views on this? Why is it that people feel it's necessary to introduce sex education into a 5-year-old to 7-year-old class? Because I'm astounded and gobsmacked.
This is the idea from the shadow.
I'm astounded and gobsmacked, John, at some of the ludicrous sort of coverage of this. So, you know, this idea that, I mean, some of the stuff I've seen in some of the papers claiming that, you know, this would be, I don't know, foisting condoms on classes of 5 to 7. It's ridiculous. It's actually simply saying that what a lot of schools do anyway, which is in an age-appropriate way, of course, talking to kids about sex and relationships as they go through school is a very, very powerful antidote to things like teenage pregnancy, to the communication of sexual diseases, to sexual harassment and bullying, to online bullying. And of course it's not about saying, you know, look, I've got a 5-year-old and 10-year-old at primary school. Do I want them to be sort of subject to information? Which, frankly, if my 5-year-old was, of course that's not the idea. I just think he'd be completely nonplussed. It's just astonishing, some of the claims that those like me who believe that it is right to equip our children as they go through school.
Isn't it the role
to
of the parents?
It's also the role of the parents. Of course it is the role of the parents. And actually, the best... the best classes...
If I had a seven-year-old, why is some teacher going to start telling him or her about... In very, very... I know very moderate terms about reproductive organs. I don't want it as a seven-year-old.
If you don't want that for your child, you can say that as a parent. The vast majority of schools who do this well do it in conjunction with parents. They talk to parents, they say what they're going to teach themselves.
I had an experience with my eight-year-old.
What happened?
He was eight at the time, and now he's nine. And he's coming home telling me he's having his lessons. I wasn't consulted.
Do you know what's in the lessons, John?
He kind of gave me his idea of what was in the lessons, but that's why it pricked my ears and went, well, surely I should have known that someone was sitting down with you guys and talking to
you. Yeah, as a parent, I actually agree with you. I think it is best if parents do know, but I also think we should, most teachers and head teachers, they're not daft. They care about the children in their care. They're not going to start saying stuff that's inappropriate to kids. I'll tell you where there's an interesting thing here, by the way, which is that... I've long believed that if I don't know what does your school does your son go to a just a maintained school or what
it's,
kind of
it's a state school
yeah yeah well you see the guidance on sex and relationship education is something that it has to be followed by sort of if I can put it like that, normal state schools, but not to free schools and academies. I think that's a bit strange. So I've tried to persuade my Conservative coalition colleagues to say, well, hang on a minute, if a little boy or a little girl deserve to be taught about sex and relationship education to make sure that they can sort of deal with things as they get older, particularly as they go into their teenage years, why aren't you going to do that for the boy and the girl in the neighbouring school that so happens to be a free school or an academy? And so I think that's what we need to do. We need to do it consistently and sensitively. And remember, the evidence is overwhelming. If you do it well, it actually helps protect the health of our children as they get older.
A trade union, thank you for that, John. A trade union, Unite, has been interviewing more than 1,000 people in a city you know well, Sheffield, asking them their voting intentions. If it is reflected in the election, it's not good news for you. LBC's reporter Ella Griffith has been on the streets of the city that is the jewel of the north.
If I had to, yeah, I would.
Why,
I would vote.
Why would you vote for him?
Because any others, I don't really like. He's nice and he does know what he's on about.
I won't be voting Nick Clegg, no, he works for Tories for a start, so we're northerners, so we're not right into Tories, I'm afraid. But I guess they're all the same though as well.
Quite likely. Not completely decided, but yes, probably will do.
Why are you thinking that you might do?
Because I think he's brought a voice of moderation to the politics of this particular government.
So there we are. Two say yes, you're nice, you do know what you're talking about, you've got a voice of moderation. One says they probably won't vote for Nick Clegg. This poll from the union suggests that Labour have 33% of the share of vote. The Lib Dems, your party, have 23%. How worried are you?
I mean, this poll is such utter bilge. Here, surprise, surprise, the trade union paymasters of the Labour Party come out with a poll which shows the Labour Party's ahead. Look, unlike these Unite bosses that sort of, pay for the Labour candidates up and down the country, I actually am out and about, I'm tomorrow, obviously, out and about, knocking on doors in the streets of my wonderful constituency in the most beautiful part of the north, southwest Sheffield, and I've been doing it for 10 years. It's one of the greatest privileges of my political life. Of course, as actually your excerpt showed, there are some people, of course, and I meet them, of course, who say, "Oh, I hate the Tories so much, I'll never forgive you for going to coalition." And of course, I try and explain to them, no one won the election. It was the only way we could form a stable government. Of course, I'm not a Tory. Far from it.
You're nice.
The longer you said it, the longer I've governed with them, the more I realise why I'm not. But if we hadn't formed that coalition, we wouldn't have pulled the country back from the economic brink. And look, it's my job, like any MP in any seat, to explain why I want to carry on serving the community that I have done for the last 10 years.
Was the boss of Boots right? The boss of Boots, Stefano, to say that Labour would be a catastrophe. If Ed Miliband got in, it would be a catastrophe. Labour subsequently went on the attack about his personal tax affairs.
Oh, look, I think his personal tax affairs are his, but he clearly would be in a strong... I mean, as I think as Boris Johnson said, it would be in a slightly stronger position to talk about, British governments and politics if he was actually a taxpayer here. But, frankly, regardless of where he pays tax or what his passport is, the point he makes about how Labour just appears to have absolutely nothing constructive to say about how we run our economy is broadly right. I mean, it just beggars belief that after what is it? They crashed the economy in 2008. It was like a near-death experience for our economy. They were responsible, not entirely, but largely for it. I haven't heard a word of remorse. I haven't heard a word of apology. Worse than that, I haven't heard a single kind of word of what they would do to avoid those mistakes in the past. In fact, Danny Alexander and I are talking about this later. The Labour Party still sticks its head in the sand, doesn't want to deal with the deficit on time over the next few years, wants to sort of drag out the whole task of dealing with the deficit. That means more years of kind of spending restraint and higher borrowing costs, which is not very fair for our kids or grandkids.
How many business leaders support the Lib Dems?
A few.
Can you name some of them?
Oh, I was talking, who was I talking to the other day? Oh, the founder of those wonderful drinks, those innocent drinks.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Who's that, then?
He's called Richard Reed.
Yeah. So you've got
innocent. There's one, yes. They have their bill.
Yeah, that was funny.
That was funny.
Right, lastly, they're through the class barrier. Middle-class shoppers now go to Lidl and Aldi proudly. When did you last go to a Lidl or an Aldi?
I went... I haven't been to a Lidl for ages. I had been to an Aldi some months ago, but but I'm not a regular Aldi or Lidl shopper.
You're not?
No.
Well, where do you choose
to go? Well, just go to the supermarkets nearby.
Right.
Sainsbury's, Waitrose, there's...
But you would go. You have no problem.
Yeah, I've got no problem.
You do a dinner party from Aldi or Lidl, as everyone...
Oh, I think one of the... this is why our shoppers, if you like, have got such amazing choice now. If you go, you know, I read something, I think it was it from... I forget where it was. Something about the kind of... Some of the best supermarkets now for wine are the
Aldi,
supermarkets you wouldn't expect.
Been revealed. Aldi is the wine retailer of the year.
So it's great. So it means they're not just competing on price, they're also competing on quality. Yeah. That's great.
More choice. They're not good on Rioja, I've heard that. Nick,
I'll pass it on.
Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg here, appearing exclusively on LBC with Call Clegg.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. Weekend mornings. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Laura in Barnet. Hello, Laura.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, I'd like to ask Nick Clegg, isn't it high time that the British stop interfering and meddling in the Middle East? We've been backing one side against another side, causing huge division. You begin to wonder if this isn't actually a policy to cause division and endless strife over there. The results of our invasion into Iraq and the occupation there have... what has led to this now? And yet, we're still talking about flying more sorties, sending more weapons. We prop up unsavoury characters like King Abdullah, who's looking... now to kill more people. Yesterday he executed two people, including a woman. Is this what we want to be part of? Surely it's not our fight. Surely it's time we had better things to do with the money that we spend on all this endless war back at home.
Well, Laura, funny enough, I think the answer is we possibly should do more on some issues and less on others. As you know, Laura, I'm the leader of the only main party in Westminster that objected to the decision, supported by both Labour and the Conservative parties, to go into war with Iraq, so fatefully all those many years ago now. So on that one, I strongly agree with you. I thought that was a huge mistake, probably one of the biggest foreign policy mistakes of modern times. I think on the present kind of conflict and violence in Syria and Iraq, I agree with you to the following extent. There's no way that we, the United Kingdom, certainly not on our own, actually not even the rest of the world altogether, will somehow be able to kind of fix the bloodshed in Syria or fix the bloodshed in Iraq. In Iraq, for instance, it requires a reconciliation between the very, very deep-seated tensions between the Shia communities and the Sunni tribes, which isn't yet happening. That's not, something we might be able to help with. In fact, there was a committee of MPs in the House of Commons who just this very morning have said we should be doing more on that. And then, of course, there is the ongoing crucible of so many tensions in the region, namely the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where my own view has long been that we have, as a country, we've sort of deferred perhaps too much to the view that America's the only country that can try and exert any meaningful influence. I've always felt that the European Union, given that it is a sort of economic superpower for the countries of the Middle East, we're by far the largest donor of assistance to Palestinian communities, we are by far the largest destination for exports of goods and services from Israel. I think we could use that economic muscle more effectively than we have done. But I guess my answer to you, Laura, is I don't think it's a sort of simple rule of should we do nothing or should we do, you know, more. I think it does slightly depend on the issue, but it needs to be done with intelligence and also with a fair degree of humility. This idea, this kind of, you know, vaguely imperial idea that I don't think very many people have them anymore, but they certainly seem to around the time of the Iraq war, that somehow we can charge into other countries and just fix everything, is clearly something which experience shows is not the case.
Laura, let's bring you back in. What would you say to Mr. Clegg?
Yes, absolutely. You can't bomb your way to peace. More murders, more killing, more deaths is not going to help. And that's why I'm so horrified at King Abdullah's response to it. I really think that we shouldn't be involving ourselves in going over there and dropping more bombs. Inevitably, innocent people get killed too, so...
Yeah, but Laura,
time being stopped.
Of course, I accept everybody listening to this, Laura, will agree with you that, of course, violence begets violence. And I'm always, by the way, very struck when I speak to senior military people, how they always say, look, military force is only one component in providing a solution to a conflict. You always have to have, you know, politics has to play its role. In Afghanistan, it's a very good example. We had our very brave servicemen and servicewomen there for many, many years. But when I went to visit them in Helmand, they would say to me, look, you know, we can do our bit as people who wield force in the military, but at the end of the day, it's the politicians in Kabul who need to kind of get their act together to create the conditions for peace. And I think everybody knows that force alone is not a solution. But sometimes, of course, it is necessary, and it is certainly, I think, justified that we play a role, only a role, not a sort of all-encompassing role in the international coalition to make sure that where ISIL is going around slaughtering innocent women and children, beheading and burning their hostages, that we play our part in seeking to, you know, keep them in check and over time roll them back, because they are an odious force who not only threaten people there, they also, of course, in the long run can threaten you, Laura, us, all of us here, because they can radicalise young Britons who might go out there, or in fact do go out there, we know that, and get absolutely immersed in the bloodshed and the warped ideology of those conflicts, and then some of them, of course, might want to come back here and inflict that violence on our own streets.
So just to explore one point that Laura made, was King Abdullah right to order the execution of the two Al-Qaeda suspects?
Look, I, and in fact the British government, and we as a country, are in principle opposed to the death penalty. So, you know, however... understandably enraged the people of Jordan are by this, I mean, unspeakably barbaric sight of one of their own kind being burned alive. I mean, it's just...
Did you see the video?
No, I haven't seen it, actually. I haven't. Have you?
I have.
Yeah. No, I haven't.
You cannot describe it.
Yeah.
The way they plan it, the way it is executed, I mean that word.
And I'm told the way,
the way it is mixed with effects, the way music is put over it. Mm. It is almost like the days I would suggest of Nazis or Pol Pot. Mm. It is just beyond sinister.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and for those very reasons.
But then the execution of those two.
Well, all I'm saying is that I can totally understand the who could possibly not understand the absolute rage of the Jordanian people. Do I think that deploying the death penalty is a solution? I'm afraid you have to be principled on the death penalty. You either believe as a society that you use it or you don't. We've believed as a country for a long time, and I certainly support that we don't.
And then lastly on this, you'll have seen one of the front pages of the newspaper this morning, The Guardian. Step up the fight against ISIS, say MPs. The Guardian refers to it as a trenchant report that Britain is not doing enough. We need to be more robust. Are they right?
I don't think they're right. I heard Rory Stewart, who's a Conservative MP, but knows a lot about the region, and I think he was speaking very thoughtfully about this, so I don't want to dismiss it lightly at all, and I certainly would want to have a good look at the report that they have produced. But I think to the suggestion, at least, maybe this is the way it was just reported, that somehow our commitment can be measured according to the number of boots on the ground in Baghdad. I think that is a misplaced measurement. Where I do accept at least some of the commentary I've heard just fleetingly this morning is the importance of using British expertise to get the Sunni tribes in Iraq to feel more comfortable with the government in Baghdad, because of course it's the fact that the Sunni tribes in Iraq are disenchanted with their own government in Iraq, which is giving ISIL the space to run riot and inflict their grotesque violence in large parts of Iraq right now.
We move on to other questions, Mr.
Nigel in Chadwell Heath. Hello, Nigel.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Just in relation to this Julian Assange case, I'm a little bit mystified. Perhaps you could enlighten me. I understand that it's costing thousands of pounds on a daily basis to maintain vigil outside the Ecuadorian embassy. He sought refuge then. Of course, he's entitled to it once he's inside the refuge, the embassy. As I understand, it's now regarded as Ecuadorian territory. Hardly a friendly act on behalf of the Ecuadorian government. Why on earth don't we just close the Ecuadorian embassy, ask their diplomats to leave, and arrest him on the way out? How long is this farce going to continue?
Now, this is after the LBC put in an FOI, Mr. Clegg, and discovered the cost is now more than £10 million. I don't know why, but it's around £10,000 a day, and it is now over £10 million has been spent guarding the embassy.
For the police.
For policing costs, I'm so sorry. In which Mr. Assange is holed up, Mr. Clegg.
Well, Nigel, look, am I frustrated that this goes on like this? Am I frustrated that taxpayers are picking up, the tab around the Ecuadorian embassy? Yeah, sure. Just imagine the frustration of the Swedish government. Hardly a, how can I put it, in a liberal rogue state. This is a country of impeccable democratic credentials with a well-respected judicial system, who say that he should go to Sweden to face very serious allegations and charges of I think it's of rape.
Potential rape, which he denies.
But and of course, the right thing for him to do is to do that. It's just to face justice, and face justice in a country, as I say, where due process is well established.
But I don't think we can shut embassies down, Mr.
No, Nigel. I don't look. The whole point about embassies is that you have embassies. We all have embassies in countries where we don't particularly get on with them, and we have embassies of countries which we don't particularly agree with. I mean, that's the whole point about having embassies, is that you maintain a link between countries, even at moments of tension. And I think, therefore, you need to think very, very carefully, and only in very exceptional circumstances, close embassies altogether, and so sever all links with other countries.
This £10 million, and £9 million for a Chilcot inquiry, which we still haven't seen. Sir John appeared before a panel of MPs yesterday. How do you think he fared, Mr. Clegg?
I didn't see it all. How can I put this? I think
he was a bumbling civil service lifer, Mr. Clegg.
Well,
how would you respond?
I'm sure that is an impolite way of talking about a distinguished gentleman who's running a very important process. His reputation, I think, will rest more heavily on the quality of his final report than the actual performance before that select committee. And that's why we're all waiting, to put it mildly, with bated breath for the report finally to be produced.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. Weekend mornings from 10 on LBC. Saturday with Ken Livingstone and David Mellor.
This dawn that has arisen over Greece, inspiring hope around the world.
Kenneth, but I mean, can I recognise a smear? I can recognise when you're smearing, Kenneth. It's when your lips move.
Sunday with Beverly Turner.
There's been a sort of reduction, hasn't there, in the dignity and the respect that we afford old people. You know, you used to be able to turn to an old timer, didn't you, to explain the world. Now we get on Google. If we have trouble working the computer, we ask a teenager. If we're not respecting our old people enough, how are we going to give them the right source of care that they need?
Leading Britain's conversation, weekend mornings from 10 on LBC. On FM. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Go straight to the first call, who is Stan in the city, I believe. Is that my father, Stan?
Yeah, no, I'd totally deny that one, mate.
You're not my father. All right, that's all right then.
No,
okay, go on.
No, hopefully not.
The problem with the cycle superhighway is in the East End of London, pollution levels are now exceeding 50% of EU levels, and the pollution in London is actually currently killing 4,000 people a year. The superhighway, which starts at Tower Hill, where, according to the pollution map, is one of the highest in London.
Yes, Stan.
Number one, I asked you this back in November, are there going to be any left and right turns on and off of the highway for vehicles, or is everyone in the east of London having to go through the centre of London to get to the city and the West End?
Also, on
your own report, the impact of NO2 was recently officially recognised for the first time, although it was buried on your page 108...
Of the Cycle Superhighway report?
As a part of the old emissions report.
In November,
I said to you that nitro oxide emissions, which is actually part and parcel of diesel vehicles, was going to an all-time high. And you said, no, it wasn't. You said it was going down. So, number one, I expect an apology because your own report contradicts what you said. And now you're decision
to
make all your zero emissions that have called now Nissan to pull out of the London taxis. Now, London...
Oh, Stan again. Yes, I remember you, Stan. Yes, no, well, you're... No, okay, okay.
Taxis only account for 3%. Your buses count 16% of vehicles on London roads. And
well, hang on, but they taxis account, as you know, for a considerably higher proportion of emissions in the central zone. And particularly...
The reason they do is because you forced through a new Euro 4 and 5 vehicles, which actually gives out up from 10 to 15% of the previous ones. The new Euro 4 and 5 vehicles,
well,
forced everyone to buy, and now on average 30%.
Right, okay, Stan, what we're trying to do, and I think what I said to you last time, which is absolutely correct, is that not only have nitrous oxide levels come down in the last 7 years. The emissions have come down, I think, by 20%. The concentrations in some of the worst bits of London are down by 12%. PM10s, PM2.5s, which is the nasty dust stuff which you see belching out of the back of London cabs, and I see it the whole time because I cycle behind them, they've come down by, I think, 15%. But we've got to go further. As you rightly say, Stan, there are 4,300 people who die every year in London prematurely because of poor air quality, and we've got to get more cycling on our streets, and we've got to get cleaner vehicles. So that's why we're bringing in the ultra-low emission zone, and we will make sure that taxis by 2018, new taxis coming into London will be able, with subsidy from us, from government, will be able to get hold of fantastic new ultra low emission vehicles, and that is,
where
I think, what people want to see. Well, as I think I said to you last time, there are several people in the market. There's a Turkish company, Carsan. There's Fraser Nash, a British company. You're incorrect to say... Fraser Nash electric taxis, by the way, Stan, are actually running on the streets of London as we speak. So, you know...
Where can we charge them? Where can we charge the vehicles? There's 30,000 taxis. Where are you going to allow 30,000 vehicles to pull up and start charging? The charge, a slow point, takes up to 6 to 8 hours. A rapid point, which is detrimental to batteries, 6-30 minutes. Plus, out of all the taxi drivers, what about the ones...
You seem to be arguing from two different points of view at once. On the one hand, you're complaining about air quality in London, and you're simultaneously saying that we shouldn't go ahead with a programme of cleaner vehicles. I think you need to get your story straight, with great respect to you.
Let's listen to the man. What we
want to do, and obviously I understand the technical difficulties that you're drawing attention to, but we are confident that we can have a charging network and that will allow taxis to go through the central. We're talking about the central congestion charging zone. Sometimes, Stan, you know, great cities have got to do difficult things in order to make life better for everybody, and that is what we are doing with the ultra low emission zone. I thought you were going to have a pop at me about the cycle superhighway, because I understand Mr. Nick Ferrari, the spokesman of everybody who is indignant about the cycle superhighway, is girding his loins for an assault on this particular subject.
Good morning,
later on.
But
I'm braced for that.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming in.
How can it be? Just picking up on a point that Stan made.
Yeah.
You have 30,000 taxis.
I think 32,000, yes.
Where are they all going to charge if they all go electric?
A lot of them can charge at home, and there will be charging points, and there will be...
What, 30,000?
Yeah, it is possible to charge your vehicle at home.
Right.
And there's
the come in, I do a long shift. I would imagine my battery is probably going to drain pretty quick.
And there will be charging points at taxi ranks and at places where taxis gather. And that is the obvious. That is the obvious thing to do.
30,000, though, there's nothing like enough, will there?
No, well, 30,000 vehicles. You don't need 30,000 charging points.
Right. Is your dream that every cab will be electric?
Well, every cab that goes through the centre of the city should be capable of zero emission performance, and Stan began quite rightly complaining about the poor air quality in London, and he said, and he actually accused me wrongly of making it worse. It's not true; it's got better, but we need to make it still better. And one way to do that, in fact, the best way to do that, is to work with the technology that is coming on stream to allow people to drive low emission vehicles. And I mean, you know, I think this is an incredibly exciting prospect for London and for this country.
What, the electric cars?
Some of these technologies we lead the world in.
Right.
Our new bus is one of the cleanest, greenest in the world, the new generation Routemaster bus. That's driving British jobs in Northern Ireland. Fraser Nash is a Hampshire company. You know, these are technologies that we can lead the world in and indeed export. Now, what I think Stan and his colleagues are rightly concerned about is when they come on, what's going to be the economics for the taxi driver? How does it work for me as a taxi driver if I have to pay a huge amount of money up front for a pricey electric or plug-in hybrid
vehicle?
Which
I've got to plug into the mains.
Exactly. How am I going to... Well, what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that there is a substantial subsidy from the Office of Low Emission Vehicles.
Substantial.
I can't give you the figure now, but it will represent a substantial proportion of the cost.
How much is one of these cars
going
to cost?
Well, actually, the figures I have seen suggest that they are not very far north of the existing cost of... Taxis cost an absolutely insane amount of money.
What does a taxi cost?
It costs about £30,000 or £40,000.
£30,000 or £40,000.
Something like that. They are hugely expensive.
Right.
And
how much is one of these Fraser Nash ones?
I'm told that they will be comparable. And if you think about the saving that you will get over the lifetime of the vehicle in fuel costs, it will work out as a fantastic deal for the driver. So that's what we want to get over to people.
I know Stan wants to get more involved, but we have got other matters.
Come on, let's go to Michael in Bristol.
Hello, both of you.
Good morning.
I'm great admirer of both of you, by the way, and LBC Radio's wireless station.
Fantastic. Leading Bristol's conversation, as we say.
I'm Vinegar Mike, by the way.
Oh, right.
Oh, yes, always good talking to you.
Boris is a great supporter of Vinegar's.
Right.
Can I just say to you, Boots, I'm Boots. A Labour supporter Boots. Of Boris, but don't worry, I don't admire you, I do.
Right, good.
I'm going to say that, but I will not be going into Boots anymore. I don't need to anyway, because my cider vinegar takes all that proper away.
Right.
I'm the thorn in their
side. No. So I want to move you to the question. So, do you think Boots was wrong, the boss of Boots?
I think it's wrong for a company to have their political views. Mm-hmm. So, all right, for you MPs to have the political views, yep. You're fighting for it. But
not Stefano Pessina, who's the chief executive of Boots, using the word catastrophe if Ed Miliband was to come to power.
Well, I think the head of Boots is perfectly entitled to his view, and I think actually too often you have a lot of nervousness in great corporations about speaking out on political issues, and capitalists typically will be wary of any kind of uncertainty. They won't want to offend any politicians because they're worried they may actually get in and then start persecuting them. So I think it's quite refreshing to see some tycoon actually saying what he thinks. I think it is absolutely true. If you look at the modern Labour Party, they have no interest in wealth creation. They don't understand that in order to have a strong and healthy society, you've got to support the businesses that create the tax revenue, that employ people, that put bread on the table for people. Otherwise, you cannot begin to pay for the poorest and the neediest, for the welfare state, for hospitals, for everything else. Jesse Boot, when Jesse Boot founded that company in Nottingham in the century before last,
yes.
He started a most amazing British business, and it continues to drive jobs and drive employment in spite of, you know, some very, very difficult times. And I think actually you should listen to what the guy from Boots has to say.
Of course, he's moved the HQ from Nottingham to Switzerland to save money.
Well,
how appropriate is that?
He is doing his best by the the lights of his shareholders and by the interests of
the interests
of the company. He's got to, you know, these guys are, I'm afraid, have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to minimise their obligations. And
so it's acceptable.
He
applies the bulk of his trade in the UK, but chooses to locate his company in Switzerland and therefore save hundreds of millions of pounds in tax. That is acceptable.
Well,
in your world of economics, Mr.
In business terms, it's what he's got to do. I have to say, I find it a little bit disappointing that he doesn't cough up for Britain. That is my view, and I've made that view plain.
In many other cases. So you agree when I don't think people in Britain are going to take kindly to being lectured by someone.
No, I don't agree.
Respectfully, Mr. May, you've just said the same thing. I don't think people in Britain will take kindly to being lectured by someone who's avoiding his taxes on how they should be voting in the UK general election. You've just said that.
No. It's two completely different things.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC.
Sex lessons at five under Labour, and this is no made-up headline, it's absolutely true. Children aged five would have sex education classes if Labour won the general election. Shadow Education Secretary Tristram Hunt said the subject would go on the primary school curriculum. The reason? Well, it would help tackle homophobic bullying. The lessons are currently only given to children of secondary school age. Obviously, you can all work that out. That's 11 and above. Labour says Mr. Hunt wanted age-appropriate teaching about sex and relationships to begin in Key Stage 1, that's pupils age 5, up till 7. They say it'll help tackle the problems of domestic violence and rape in later life. Really? Campaigners, though, have warned against what they call sacrificing childhood innocence for the sake of political correctness. We'll speak to one of those campaigners in just a second. Some of the background: sex education is a compulsory subject in all council-run secondary schools in England. By law, the schools have to provide lessons in sex and relationships from children the age of 11. Parents are able to withdraw the children from class from those lessons, apart from those that are part of the core science curriculum. The rules do not apply, I repeat, do not apply, to over 4,000 academies and free schools which are not required to teach the national curriculum. Under these plans from Labour, all state-funded schools, including academies and free schools, would provide sex and relationship classes from the age of five. It is, as I say, to try and outlaw the problems of homophobic bullying, people being called gay, and also, they say, Labour say, it could tackle the problem of underage pregnancy. Margaret Morrissey is from Parents Out Loud. She's quoted in one of these newspaper articles. Margaret's been a governor and a PTA member and a former lay inspector with Ofsted. And you're angry, Margaret Morrissey. Good morning. Why?
I'm angry and I'm very tired of it all. This has been going on for many years. When we get education secretaries or shadow education secretaries, they seem to lose all sense of reason and you know, suggest the most ridiculous things. Now, previously when this arose, and I put it up on my website, parents were in huge agreement. We will deal with our five-year-old children. Yes, there will be some who don't. There will always be some who don't. And we have to be very sensitive to those, and teachers are. But on the whole, we want to leave 5 to 7 year olds with the huge degree of innocence that the majority have, and do not taint all children, because sadly, there are some poor children who are treated badly. We deal with that. We don't decide to teach 5 year olds about explicit sex, because...
Well, hang on. Whoa. Where do you get the idea it will be explicit sex, Margaret Morrissey? Who told you that?
Well, I know the sort of immaterial, as another person in the article quoted does, that is put in front of our youngsters, and many parents...
Without being too graphic, what sort of things are we talking about?
Well, then? You know, it's...
I honestly don't know. My children are in their 20s. I have no idea what's put in front of children.
And you're very lucky. And mine are actually in their 40s.
Oh, right.
But I have 7 grandchildren, ranging from 5 to 17. And the 17-year-old, fine, she's more or less escaped the nonsense. But I fear...
But what sort of thing are we talking about? I think you use the word explicit. Again, I rely on you not to say anything inappropriate. But what are we talking... Are we talking about actual physical positions, then, for 5-year-olds? Being shown positions.
Well, I mean, each school will be different, because each school will have its own materials, although there are prescribed materials.
Yeah.
And we're talking about when you're gay, what you would do with another person
right.
who is also gay. And, you know, I don't have a problem with it. I understand that we are all different and that we all have different choices. But I do not want a five-year-old, anybody's five-year-old, to be given information that is absolutely correct, but they don't understand. It can be very frightening for a small child.
Stay on the line, Margaret Morrissey. Listening to Dr. Bernard Gallagher, a child protection expert. Are you uncomfortable with this, or do you see the merits?
I'm not uncomfortable with it at all, and I think it does have a lot of merits. And obviously, with young children, it would have to be done, it's particularly important, it's done in an appropriate way. But in principle, I'm very happy with the idea.
Hearing there that some children might be frightened by it, there is surely some truth to what my other contributor is suggesting.
I don't think children will be frightened by it. And I think, if anything, I think the big issue here is about adults' fear of sex, really. I think that, you know, societies generally find it quite difficult to deal with any sexual matters in a sort of responsible way. We prefer, you know, to have a sort of titillating sort of attitude towards it. I think Tristan Hunt's suggestion is a very sensible one, that in an age-appropriate manner, even with relatively young children, it's quite appropriate to teach them. If we're talking about 5 and 6-year-olds, for example, you know, we'd be talking about very sort of basic biological aspects of sex, if you like. And as I was saying to your researcher earlier, a lot of parents of young children will have the experience of their young child, you know, asking what's a penis.
But that's fine, isn't it? That's fine.
What's a vagina for? And parents will explain in a very basic, sort of simple manner.
So let the parents do it. Why have they got to do it in class?
Sorry?
So let the parents do it. Why has it got to be done in class?
Because a lot of parents won't do it, and some parents feel quite uncomfortable with it. And I think at the end of the day, you know, sex and relationships are absolutely sort of central to our lives, basically, as we get older. And it's really essential that children are given a proper knowledge and understanding of sex and relationships. Now,
come back to you in a second. Margaret Morrissey, are you shouting at the radio?
I am. I'd just like to pick this gentleman up and shake him a little bit. I mean, do you remember what you were told at five?
Nothing about sex.
Good things. You don't remember. Well, perhaps you do remember really nasty things. And, you know, why is it important at five? At 5 years old, you need to be playing with toys, playing games with other children. We are pushing into very young children information they will one day need and one day appreciate. Between the ages of 5 and 7. Trust me, I've had 2 kids, I've got 7 grandchildren. I've looked after some of them every day of their life. I do have lots of experience. And of course they ask questions. But, you know, it's very rare. And I don't think you would ever find a 5-year-old child saying, what's a vagina for? Unless someone put that word into their mind. Do you want to be walking around the supermarket and your child shout across the room, oh, has she got a vagina that the man does that with? No, we don't.
I think a lot of people wouldn't want that. A lot of people wouldn't want their child shouting that out. But I must say, I think your point, in a way, evidences the fact that we are scared, in a sense, about calling body parts by their proper names. You know, a lot of children would be calling them their fairies or their tuppences or whatever, but that isn't the proper name. And I think at the end of the day, yeah, we might be feel uncomfortable, but we've got to get over that uncomfortableness. You know, we've got to sort of, you know, see things for what they are, basically, and not be frightened of them.
I don't care what I feel and what other adults feel. My whole life has been focused around protecting, helping, supporting and caring for children, and I care what a 5-year-old feels. And I just think that we have started and are continuing to erode childhood. Many years ago, I fought with David Meller, who was the drug czar, when we talked about drugs education. We made it more and more explicit. We told them what the drugs looked like, we told them what they were for, and now there are many places and many schools, and I could point you to them, where children take drugs like sweets, because we explained it all when they were very young. The young people try it, and it has ruined their lives. And I will fight this man every step of the way.
All right. Those are the battle lines. Dr. Bernard Gallagher, thank you. Margaret Morrissey, thanks to you as well. Which side of those battle lines are you on? More after this. 9:15.
I'm Chris Goldsey, the LB.
Let's get the mums and dads on the radio now and hear what they have to say. Now, Jennifer, you've been campaigning against this for some time, haven't you? Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
It was a leaflet that your daughter was given. Was it at her school a year or so ago?
Yeah, it wasn't a year ago. It was just November getting to December.
Right.
Yes, last year. She was given a letter, and as I read it, it was just a vague letter saying that, the kids are going to be taught sex education, mm-hmm. and it's going to cover relationship and hygiene. But it was just very vague, and I wasn't at peace. So I went to the school the next day and requested to see the materials and the teaching plans for the lesson. And I actually went to see the student counselor, and she said that, you know, I'm not supposed to have this booklet that was going to be used, but as a parent, I have a right to look at it. So yep. She gave it to me. I brought it home. When I opened it, I could not believe what was in there.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
There is no upside. The words of a woman whose mother recently went into care. Throughout 2015, I'll be looking at a subject that's breaking hearts and bank accounts across the UK.
It's then when he said to me, this is torture, and I put my hand down his back and I could feel where the hoist was digging into his back.
I'll get some of the people whose job it is to plan and deliver social care in one room and ask them why in 21st century Britain this is happening.
There was a patient opposite my dad who had Parkinson's, got out of his bed to go on a wander, fell flat on his face. The nurse was actually standing at the glass sheet looking at him and walked off the opposite way. I ended up getting out of my seat, going over and picking him up.
Care Minister Norman Lamb will take your calls, and I want your family's stories.
Sheila Fogarty, weekday afternoons from 1, only on LBC. Weekend morning.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Asked to do it by the previous government, and as you know, the original assertion made by Gordon Brown at the time was that this would be all complete within a year. I don't know, how many years is it now?
It's 4 years to the month since the last person gave evidence. Five and a half years since it started.
Yeah, and I am, you know, I'm deeply frustrated that it's taking so long. He sought to explain yesterday why it's taking so long.
I must have missed that bit. He was asked, when might it be ready? I don't know. Can you give us a rough sense? I don't know. Has everyone who needs to be maxwellised? I'm not going to tell you. How many have replied who've been maxwellised? I'm not going to tell you. You thought those were answers?
I think he should set. I mean, he's independent. Do stress this. You know, I mean, I've written letters to him. He's written back to me. I can urge him as much as I do to get on with it. But at the end of the day, he has to determine the work of his own commission. I do, however, think, given how, you know, disenchanted the public's become by the delay of this, he would do his own work a power of good just to set some deadlines and to force the pace. And, look, I understand this maxwellisation, which is basically jargon for a bit of to and fro between those who have criticised and so they've got a reasonable opportunity to respond. Everybody accepts that, you've got to have a deadline to that, and that's why I've suggested to him, look, even if you can't do it before the election, just tell us when.
Yeah. When you're Prime Minister this May...
Yes.
What
can would be can the, you just say that again, Nick? I didn't hear
what
that.
Would be the point at which government would intervene?
This is a prediction. prediction.
We're getting on so
I cling.
If you can get the sort of numbers that we're getting at LBC, you'd be in with a landslide.
Effortlessly.
These figures are extraordinary. We'd have more than a working majority if we were in power, Mr. Glenn. We'd be running the world. Now, back to this. I mean, how much longer up with this we will put? Another year? 2 years? At what point would the government say, whoever the Prime Minister might be, he or she...
Well, since you asked about my own view, my patience is running very thin indeed.
I mean, right. You know, so you give him 12 months?
I really hope that commission produces its report as quickly after the general election as possible.
Six months after the general election.
I'd like it to be a matter of weeks after the general election, ideally. It cannot go on for much longer like this, because otherwise I think people will... You know, we'll feel that the final product, even if it's a very distinguished, balanced, decisive product, people will kind of...
They've made up
their
minds.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. The longer this runs on, the credibility of the whole process will then start sullying the content of it.
We move to other matters, Mr. Craig. Where are we going now?
John, yes? In Eastbourne. Hello, John.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Craig. I'd just like to take up an issue with you, if I may. It's a matter you have dealt with before on LBC. Yeah. My question to you is, this week on Monday, on the BBC News 24, they did show some terrible footage in there of what was going on in a Harrah slaughterhouse in North
Yorkshire. Oh, yes.
Presume you're aware of that?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
I mean, the thing is, Nick, in Britain, we always had pride of ourselves in the past to try and set good standards, and I just think Denmark has now put an outright ban on Harrah slaughter. And obviously, you know, a slaughterhouse is never going to be a pleasant place for any normal person to want to go and visit for a day out, but, you know, I think at the end of the day, all livestock animals should be slaughtered humanely. Yeah. And I find it totally inexcusable that your party, the Tory party and the Labour party, are all totally in favour of animals being slaughtered without any pre-stunning. I just do not know in the 21st century how you're justifying that.
So John, firstly, I was deeply shocked by those reports of what was happening in that slaughterhouse. And thankfully, the Food Standards Agency or authority, I forget which one it is, but anyway, they've gone in, they've taken, I think they've revoked the licence from that abattoir.
But if I can just interrupt you then, sorry, the plant was the very next day was still carrying on working. An animal aid apparently done...
Sorry to interrupt, the slaughtermen have been suspended. The slaughtermen who've been filmed by animal aid...
I should have been more precise. They've been suspended. You're quite right, John. John, can I just... here's the nub of it for me. What those individuals were doing was just cruel, right? They were kicking the heads of some of these poor animals. They were abusing them. And here's my point: that could have happened in an abattoir which was either killing animals, you know, on halal principles, or stunning them. That's not the, you know, in a sense, it's not whether it was halal or not. That could have happened. That kind of arbitrary, inhumane cruelty could have happened in a slaughterhouse which was stunning all the animals beforehand. So I just don't accept the implication of your question that this was because they were being killed according to halal principles. And I think it is right for us to say, particularly to our Jewish and Muslim communities in our country, you have the right to have food prepared and animals slaughtered according to your traditions. It needs to be done humanely, and that is what, on the whole, I think, does happen. The cruelty we saw there was nothing to do, I think, with the fact that it was that those animals were being slaughtered according to halal principles. They could have, as I said, been just as badly abused and cruelly treated, even if they were subsequently stunned.
John?
Well, if I can just quickly come back to you on that one. Animal Aid apparently did covert video in 10 slaughterhouses, 10 Harrah slaughterhouses, and nine of the slaughterhouses, they found terrible abuses against the animals. So at the end of the day, you know, a bolt to the head is the only sane, decent way to dispatch an animal if it's going to go into the food chain. To cut an animal's throat wide open, leave it conscious for a few minutes after, is totally unacceptable in any civilised society. And I still say, and I'm sure many people out there today listening to me will agree, that in the 21st century, your party, the Tory party and the Labour party, need to take a moral stand on this and to say, We want all our livestock slaughtered in a humane manner.
Well, I think on one specific issue, you and I are just going to disagree. I take, if you like, the moral standpoint that our Jewish and Muslim communities, according to very, very long-standing, indeed ancient customs, want to maintain the tradition of having animals slaughtered in a particular way. And I think it's right for us in a plural, tolerant society to do that. That can be done in a way which is entirely consistent with our equally strongly held views about animal welfare. My point to you is, someone who wants to kick a sheep in a head will do that as randomly and cruelly as that, regardless of what subsequently happens to that animal, whether it's stunned or not.
We move on to other calls. John, thank you.
Niran, is it Niran or Niran in Edgware?
Yes, Niran.
Hello, Niran.
Good morning, Nick. Okay. Just wanted to give you a background about myself. I am a Jew who left Iraq in the beginning of the 70s. Now, I left because I was singled out as a nation or as a race because I'm Jewish. I was persecuted, not myself, but I mean as a community. I left Iraq, I came to the UK. But unfortunately, in the last few years,
specifically now, I'm feeling that I am reliving what I lived in Iraq through my children. I have to protect them. I have to avoid sometimes to say that I'm a Jew. And it's actually very, very sad. It saddens me that I come to this country knowing that it's a free country and I have to live that. Now, the second thing, I just want to ask your opinion about anti-Semitism. I do not call it anti-Semitism. It's racism because this race is being singled out. And as far as I know, it's a crime in this country and in all of Europe.
Naran, can I? I mean, it's extremely shocking, and as you say, not only sad, it's very sad, it's also very worrying indeed that you feel that you are as intimidated now here as you were when you lived in Iraq as a Jew, and that that should worry anyone who believes in the values of tolerance and openness for which Britain is has been you know, long famous. Can I just ask, though, Niran, a little bit more about, because as you may have heard in the news this morning, there's been this report published by the Community Security Trust, which is this excellent trust which does work to keep Jewish communities up and down the country safe. They provide protection in synagogues, schools and so on. You mentioned just earlier your children. Tell me more about, has anything happened?
No, thank God. Thank God nothing happened.
Right.
But I am very, very careful. I try to take my son to school and try to pick him up from school. I'm trying to avoid, I'm asking him to avoid to show his logo, you know, his emblem on his jacket, because it's a known Jewish thing. We never, I mean, I'm not religious, my family are not religious. I never, especially recently, I used to be before when I came to this country. Now, we don't. They don't put a kippah on the head. Not to show that I'm a Jew. This is exactly what happened in Iraq.
Well,
exactly
I'm
the same thing.
Yeah. Well,
and it's frightening. It's frightening.
Of course it is. And I know my sympathy, of course, goes to you and to anybody else who feels the same, and indeed to your children. And of course, the tragedy of it, and it really is a tragedy, is that just as incidents of violence, discrimination, hatred, even appear to be on the rise. Against members of our Jewish communities up and down the country, there are also incidents of anti-Muslim hatred and violence increase. I mean, this is the terrible thing, is that at a time of great international tension and violence and all the other worries that people have, is that you get communities sort of, you know, in a sense, set up against each other. And we all need to work with you, we need to work with organisations such as the CST to say loud and clear that in this country, everybody's equal before the law. Everybody is entitled. We've just had a discussion about my view that we should protect the halal traditions for Jewish and Muslim communities. People should be able to maintain their traditions in a way which allows people to coexist peacefully. And I am very anxious, Niran, that we as a government should do, as we are, should do everything we can to work with you, with your community, with your family, with the CST, to make sure you feel safer than you do right now.
Well, that's all very worthy, Mr. Craig. What are you going to do with David Ward, one of your MPs, who continually tweets anti-Semitic comments?
Well, this is where it gets difficult, or it gets at least
You're the leader of the party.
Well, no, here, let me tell you. I don't think when he, for instance, made the most crass, insensitive remark about the Prime Minister of Israel being in Paris after the Je suis, do I think that was racist? I thought it was daft. I thought it was offensive. I understand that, but I don't think it was racist.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
We go to Roy in Tilbury.
Good morning, Boris.
Good morning, Roy.
I'd like to go and congratulate you on your comments of last week.
I know you're not going to say the word. If it's what I think it is, please don't say the word.
It rhymes with bankers.
Thank you.
You spoke about the Islamic extremists.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I'd like to congratulate you on that. But the only thing that worries me is, do you think that by saying that, that some of these people might now target you and the people around you?
Well, you know, let's be clear what I was saying. I think it's very, very important to bear in mind that You know, there is some evidence, and that quite a large proportion of these people are exactly as I describe, and the colourful phrase that I use, which Mr. Ferrari has forbidden us from using on air, and I will bow to his censorship.
Yes, I would refer you to the broadcasting code.
We'll toss us.
Just the once. Okay. Just the once.
Tosses.
Please, okay. No more.
There is a lot of evidence on. It's more important than hang on, let me just finish. It's more important than that. Sure. There's a wider range of problems going on in these young men's lives.
Yeah.
And what I think we need to do is demystify this whole business and say that, you know, these are people who are in search of something that makes them feel powerful, makes them feel strong, makes them feel relevant. And, you know, I noticed that some people took offence at what I said, or some people claimed to have taken offence at what I said. And frankly, I just find that incredible. When you consider...
Well, they
when
said you the consi- language wasn't helpful.
When you consider... Yeah. When you consider... Well, I think what I heard was that people were saying that I had made an equivocation between jihadis and Muslims, or that I was saying that the two were the same, coterminous. Absolute nonsense. This is the most important distinction to make. This creed, this death cult that would be ludicrous if it wasn't so disgusting, has nothing to do with Islam. It is a disaster, and what I would like to see, by the way, is a more robust intellectual dismissal of what is going on in these people's heads, and I've said that as well. But, you know, frankly, if you meet the victims of these people, the widows of men who have been shot simply because they didn't belong to the right type of Islam, you see what's going on in Syria and in northern Iraq, where you've got mass rapes, you've got beheadings of innocent journalists. I think it is important to demystify these guys.
Referring to them as the word that rhymes with bankers, or the word that you've used just there on two occasions, how does that help? How does that language help?
Well, I'm sorry, I think I just answered the question. It is very, very important that we do not in any way sanctify these people or think that they are somehow protected from a spot of normal common or garden abuse.
Right.
Why is it?
So you refer to other people in those terms, do you?
Not habitually, no. But then most other people that I know of don't go around beheading innocent people.
What about your own safety, which was the point the caller made? Are you concerned? Has there been contact from Scotland Yard?
No. And anyway, I wouldn't, go into that sort of thing on air anyway. And, you know, as it goes without saying that, if you look around this broadcasting studio, most of the people here are actually on my security detail anyway, but I can't identify them at the risk of, you know...
But you have no concerns for your safety.
Listen, I think that, you know, generally speaking, I think that the police do a fantastic job, and the security
no, no, no,
service
no, no,
do a fantastic
job. You have no
job,
concerns for your own safety.
Of course not.
Okay.
And I think that the police do a fantastic job in keeping our city safe.
Nice.
The point I was going to make is we can never be complacent. We can never be complacent. And at any one time, there are a large number of people, perhaps in the low thousands, who do present some measure of potential risk. And as you know, Sorry, say again?
How many low thousands?
Well, in the low thousands. So not...
Yeah, how,
you know,
like 2,000?
Of that order.
Between 2 and 3,000?
Maybe, you know, 3, 4, something like that.
Between 3 and 4,000 of these
I can't,
are
you know,
out
the,
there.
These are ballpark figures, okay?
Mm. It'll be
wrong. Anyway, the police...
But it's that many,
the
3 to 4,000.
The police do...
And you're told that by MI5 and the Met.
The police do a... And the security services do...
You get those figures from the MI5 and the Met, do you?
Those figures are well in the public domain, Nick. There's no scoop here, you know.
Right. But that's where you get them.
Yeah, they're the figures that are commonly used.
And that's where you got the briefing about the banker's line.
You know, I don't want to go... If you forgive me, I don't want to go into the details of the briefings I have from the security...
But that's where you got that idea
but
from. But
suffice it to say...
There is
such a phenomenon. It is part of a wider syndrome. It is absolutely vital in this conversation that everybody in this conversation makes the intellectual distinction between jihadis and Muslims. And
absolutely.
As soon as you start confusing or equivocating between those two terms, as some people in their criticisms of me unfortunately seemed to do,
absolutely.
Then you really are conceding and losing a lot of ground.
I just want to nail it. The idea of the bank banking, or the bankers, came from an MI5 briefing.
I'm not going to comment any further on the briefings I have.
Where do we go next?
We go to Anne in Putney. No, I don't know why you say that. We go to Anne in Putney.
Morning. Wow, I almost dropped off then.
I'm so sorry.
Mr. Johnston,
ah.
Is there any chance, if you don't get elected at the general election, if those people of that constituency decide to reject you, God forbid, would you consider American politics? Because I need enough notice in order to go out and buy myself some flags to put up.
Well, you're sweet. So it's perfectly true that that I was born in America. There was nothing I could do about it. I wanted to be close to my mother at the time, and there she was. However, I haven't lived there since I was 5 years old. And much though I admire America and admire what and love American culture, I think it would be my life and career is here in Britain. And I want to obviously see what more I can do here.
Well, got a bit of energy. Comes out of the scrum. Whatever the hell that means.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
All right, are you satisfied with that, Anne?
The short answer is, Anne,
I love Britain. I want to stick in Britain. This is my home. This is my country.
So you don't want to be president of the United States?
Don't want to be. I think it's unlikely that I would be called upon to serve in that office.
Oh, Lord, for that. Let's get some emails. Thank you very much. Let's go to some emails. Graham in Bushy. Andrew Gilligan said on Nick Ferrari's show, the cycle superhighway would only delay traffic by a maximum of 6 minutes. If it's shown after inception that it exceeds this, would it be scrapped?
Intention.
It's a yes or no, isn't it?
Well, the answer is no, probably. But I mean, because
you and I know it's going to be more than 6 minutes.
No, we don't. Oh. We don't know. No, I think the figure I saw said 4 minutes 45 seconds.
So it can way exceed 6 minutes, and 65 million pounds.
And in some directions, sometimes it'll actually be quicker. So. I think the eastbound carriageway will.
How many miles of the cycle superhighway are there in total? Do you know?
Well, it's going to be when it's finished. I think it will be about 15 miles. It will be the longest continuous cycle superhighway in.
Well, I've got 21.
Well, there you go. It's going to be even longer than I thought. It's fantastic. It's getting better and better.
So that's over £3 million a mile. How can a cycle route cost more than £3 million?
I'll tell you why. And you know, you're right to ask, but the answer is that. In order to do the kind of cycle routes that people want, I'm afraid you have to make some pretty clever interventions in the road surface. And it is absolutely true that, as we've heard this morning from Stan, from others, from people who've called in before, there is a lot of anxiety in amongst road users about how it will impact on their lives. We are doing our absolute best to make sure that you will barely feel a thing. And that the drivers really won't be too inconvenienced by it. That requires a great deal of ingenuity, a great deal of investment, and it requires some very cunning stuff at lights, some management of traffic, and I'm afraid it requires a lot of interventions in the road surface, which is
£3 million a mile,
which, as you know, are expensive. And one of the difficulties with cycling,
£3 million a mile.
I think I'm giving you a fairly exhaustive explanation.
Moving some traffic lights. How much are they?
Well, it's not just a question of moving traffic lights, because what you've got to do is make sure that the cyclists feel safe. And I'm afraid that this is something that is not cheap, because you have to build segregated lanes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I personally, as I've said many times to TfL, don't believe in universal segregation. I don't think it's possible in London to do it. But what we're saying is that in some places where we can do it, we should do it. We can do it on this stretch. It is expensive, but it will be transformative for cycling in London and for east-west cycling.
How is the mayor... Can you be so up for something that's going to slow traffic down by a minimum of 6 minutes?
It's not going to slow traffic down.
Well, you just agreed.
It's going to slow traffic, as I said, by 4 minutes 45 seconds in one direction. And in the other direction, it will speed it up.
But
you might equally say, if you were a green, which you're not, obviously, but if you were a green car hater, you might equally say, how can you, as the mayor, conceivably put your name to something that will speed up traffic?
I'll tell you how. Because it's the white van man and woman that is driving this city.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The economic powerhouse of this entire country.
Yeah.
And without people sprinting around in their little vans and their cars and everything else, when you're going to slow them down, this great city with this incredible economic comeback, you're going to make that bloke or woman late with his deliveries.
Let me put the counter-argument. Well, counter-argument.
Fact, actually.
No, not fact. Wrong.
Well, yes, fact.
Ferrari, wrong. Wrong.
Johnson waffling.
No. What we are doing, in fact, is putting in... That's why it does cost a bit. We're putting in mitigation measures to ensure that drivers are not substantially slowed down whilst protecting cyclists. And the net advantage to London, the business case for this, is that it will make London a much more attractive place.
Mary Wolf doesn't agree.
A much more attractive place to live in. A better atmosphere for cyclists.
Yeah.
A safer city generally, and a more attractive place.
Guess what? You're not just the mayor of cycling.
There are huge economic benefits for the entire city.
What, to slow that man down in his white van, or whatever it might be? How's the advantage there? Explain.
The advantage is that people will want to come and invest in a city that they think is safe, that promotes safe and green forms of transport, where more people are feel safe enough to cycle.
You were rightly lauding big business.
That will be...
Canary Wharf is a tremendous triumph of business, British, nay, London enterprise out there in the East, and they have major concerns about this.
And they ride roughshod on your bicycle over them. I've got a huge admiration for Canary Wharf and everything that they have done, and let's be absolutely clear that they are a stunning success.
Phenomenal.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
The family of...
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Was Visit My Mosque Day, and one journalist decided she'd try and check it out. It's Channel 4's Kathy Newman. She says, though, she was turned away from a London mosque despite being respectfully dressed. She had covered her head and, obviously, her shoulders. Kathy Newman says she was ushered out of the door of the mosque in Streatham in South London, but went to another one where she received a warm welcome. Online commentators were quick to claim she could have been turned away for being a woman. We've yet to hear full details of exactly what happened. I'm wondering whether they're saving that for tonight. Of course, the joy is you can watch television and listen to LBC at the same time. In fact, if they invented radio today, it would be hailed as the biggest thing since the last biggest thing. Because you can do anything you like and listen to the radio. But back to these events. Visit My Mosque Day was organised by the Muslim Council of Britain. It was a nationwide event, I read, where a number of mosques around the country were opening their doors to the general public. The idea came in part as a genesis following the attacks by Islamic terrorists, did we all hear that, in Paris last month, which led to an apparent rise in Islamophobia in recent weeks. Mosques aim to provide an insight into the day-to-day running of a busy centre of worship, answer questions about Islam and try to demystify what goes on there, but not this particular one in Streatham, which, to my knowledge, has still yet to be identified, and we can't get through and find out which one it is. So if you are a member of it, or you do know about it, please do let me know. I should tell you, Kathy Newman was later given tea and cake at the Haideri Islamic Centre, which I assume is close to Streatham. A managing trustee at the centre says the problem was caused because Ms. Newman turned up at a mosque which wasn't taking part, but she was given a tea, cup of tea and a chat, and that is the true face of Islam. Well, hang on a second. If they had a Visit My Church Day, I can't think of a church in the land that would say to somebody, you can't come in, you're at the wrong church. I've attended synagogues, not regularly, obviously, because I'm not Jewish, and I know that there's strict policy of where men sit, where women sit, but I can't imagine, you're not coming in my synagogue. Temple, I don't think I've ever been in a temple. But I can't imagine it would be the same there, would it? Let's speak with Corsa Akhtar, who's from Surrey Faith Links, seeking to build better relationships between religions and the communities, whatever that means, joins me now. This idea's rather fallen flat, hasn't it?
Hello?
Hello. Do you think this idea, unfortunately, has rather fallen flat?
Well, no, I think you need to understand that Muslim Council of Britain do not represent every single mosque in the UK. And if you visit the website as well, they have actually listed the mosques that were participating in the Visit My Mosque Day. And, you know, even I didn't hear about it until 2 days before the actual day.
Why do you have to be signed up to allow someone into your mosque?
You don't need to be signed up to enter the mosque. All mosques are open.
They're not, are they? Respectfully, madam, they're not.
We can't make assumptions. We don't really know what happened. And I think
we do know that this woman, as part of Visit My Mosque Day, went to a mosque in Streatham. I'm afraid I don't know which one it is. I sense we might see later tonight. And was turned away. What on earth? Where's the welcome there? What's going on in a mosque that she can't go in?
Well, I can't speak on behalf, like you said as well, I can't speak on behalf of that mosque. I don't know what's happening there. I can speak on behalf of my own mosque, and hopefully I can speak on behalf of the mosque in Surrey. As we last year, we set up a Surrey Muslim Association, which includes the mosques in Surrey. And we are very open. We already have our open days. We have an annual fair at this mosque where, you know, it's welcoming to all of the communities.
Yes.
And we have, on a daily basis, trips coming to our mosque and taking visits around, that sort of thing.
Yes, so when people come to... Sorry, are your mosques open all the time then, or you have certain open days then?
Well, all the mosques are different, just like a church. Not all churches are open all of the time.
Right.
They're mostly
but
open...
If someone is in a mosque, what I'm trying to get at, if someone is in a mosque, is it then able for me to have a look around, or I can only have a look around on certain days?
If it's open, you can come and look around. But again, you know, you can understand the sensitivity in our community at this very moment in time where media do come in and distort the image. So, well, you know, I'm just trying to think of that mosque where they went in, where, you know, with cameras all blazing. You can only imagine, you know, why are they coming here? Are they coming to spy on us? Are they, you know, trying to distort what we're doing here? So, you know, we can't make any assumption that at this stage. What I would say is speak to them people, you know, and they will tell you from their own mouths what happened.
So if I...
And that's for men-only mosques, that's just ridiculous. I don't know any mosque in the UK that's men-only.
Yes.
It makes me laugh, that does.
Yes.
Women,
but you can see someone, obviously, I don't know as much about your faith, obviously, as you do, but it's just rather puzzling. You have a Visit My Mosque Day, so a journalist does, absolutely appropriately dressed as she should have been, and she's told she can't come in.
At the wrong mosque. She went to a mosque.
But I'm sorry, if it was... I'm sorry, I have to put it to you. If it was Visit My Church Day, there's no... Now, a church might hum and haw a little bit and say, oh, hang on a second, I'll go and find the verger. But they wouldn't say, you can't come in our church. What is it about a mosque?
I don't think a mosque would have said that. I think we're making assumptions.
Respectfully, madam, we do... Unless you're saying this woman's lying, and she's been an experienced journalist for many years. I mean, doesn't mean you're not a liar, but I think I'm going to take her word for this.
Yeah, it's probably because she was more of a journalist than it was because she was a woman.
Again,
and appropriately dressed.
A church wouldn't care. The faith of which I'm familiar, I would just say...
The church isn't in the limelight as extremists at this point in time, are they?
Pardon me? Pardon me?
The church are not in the limelight at this stage in time.
But don't you see what better way to emphasise the fact that, unfortunately, a small minority of people who follow your faith seek to pervert it? What better way to illustrate it than barring the door to a journalist?
I agree with you completely. Ah. A couple of weeks ago, we did a collective sermon on extremism for all the mosques in Surrey. Some of them said, no, why should we do this again when we've already done it before? And where media in the past have come in and distorted what we've said. So I understand where some Muslim communities are feeling very sensitive. They don't have trust in the media. So I understand their perspective. And I completely agree with what you're saying as well.
OK. Well, good luck with what you're trying to do at Surrey Faith Links. Thank you, Corsa Akhtar. Listening, Reverend Canon Dr. Gavin Ashenden, who's a vicar of St. Martin de Gorée on Jersey. And I have to apologise, sir. I don't know whether I address you as doctor or canon. I'm a bit confused.
Please call me Gavin.
Thank Lord for that. That makes it a lot easier. Gavin, this is an idea with great intent at the heart of it, but it appears it might have sadly backfired. How do you respond?
Well, I think the people who began the idea are really to be commended. As you say, it's great, and
It gives the opportunity for other people to get to know Islam better. When I worked in the university for 25 years, I would go and join the prayers in the university mosque and stand behind a designated line for non-Muslims, which I completely understood and respected. But I think one of the issues this raises, let us assume perhaps benignly that it might have been some PR mistake, some difficult person on a door. All organizations, even museums, have them.
Yep.
It could simply be something as banal as that. But one of the issues it raises that might be worth discussing is the way in which we understand what was implicit in your earlier conversation, which is there an equivalence between Islam and Christianity? Should we expect Islam to behave, as you were suggesting, as churches might do? And I think the answer is it's a mistake to think there is an equivalence, because it's not as if Islam is like an Oriental version of Christianity. It's
all
it's
places of worship, though, respectfully, Gavin, aren't they?
Yes, no, of course they are. So is B&Q. they are a place of worship, but it's a place of Islamic worship. And the difference, I think, is that Islam has at the heart of it an element of control and power. It is about, of course, submission. That's what Islam means. And Christianity has a very different ethos. And so we're talking about religions or cultures that have entirely different house rules. And I think one of the things we find difficult in the West is the notion that Islam is not very interested in accommodating itself to Western post-Christian values. It will live by its own rules and actually not even necessarily seek to explain them.
Lastly, the points my other contributor was making, seeking to demystify Islam so that people have a better understanding. How tortured a trail might that be getting there?
I don't think that's difficult. I think the first thing people should do is to read the Quran. One of the best ways of demystifying the Islam is to read its central text. Islam, too, of course, has a variety of cultures. There's a very gentle, mystical Sufism at one end, which is really quite close to Christianity. And I think if one was to go on a journey of exploration, one would try and start there. Although Sufis are not terribly well treated by mainstream Muslims in some parts of the world.
I will leave it there, Gavin. Thank you. Reverend Canon Dr. Gavin Ashenden, Vicar of St. Martin de Gore on Jerseys.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Boris and Nick, you both agreed to get blasted to smithereens by a water cannon. Was that yet another broken promise? Can you both confirm now if and when it would happen? If so, will it be televised?
Don't blame me either, because I'm afraid the situation at the moment is that we have the water cannon, Nick, as you know. They came over. The location I cannot disclose. They came over on, I think, a cross-channel ferry disguised as ice cream vans or rubbish vans or something like that. And they've been tested. The police have been trained on them. We await a licence from the Home Office. Until such time as the licence is issued,
the Home Secretary.
It's up to the Home Office, Home Secretary, to issue a licence.
Why is Theresa May blocking your water cannon?
Well, I don't think she is. I think she's pursuing further detailed consultations.
Well, how long does it take? Well,
put it this way. I think that if we were to get into a situation in which it were necessary to use such a device, and as I've said repeatedly on this show and many, many times to Londoners, I think that is a vanishingly improbable event, then I've no doubt that it will be readily licensed. But at the moment, we await a licence.
But when you ring up and say, Home Secretary, is Mayor Johnson here, what's the delay? What does she say?
Well, I think she wants to pursue. She's consulted with various ACPO chief constables.
But what about? What does the Commissioner of the Met say? He doesn't want to have to use them, but he wants them there if required.
I think he's in favour of a licence, but he's like me sees no particular problem with what is.
So the Home Secretary is just looking for an obstacle.
I think that
is that fair?
I'm not. You'd have to.
Well, how would you respond to that? Nick.
Look, I think we're in a very good position in the sense that
you can't use them.
Well, we don't want to use them.
No, but you can't.
We don't want to use them.
No, sure, but you can't stand in front of them.
I don't particularly want to do that until their license.
I don't care. I'm just going to do it anyway.
When they're licensed. Well, I will look into that. Actually, I will look
why
into
that. Why can't we just do it? It's going to be on private land. I'll sign any waiver you like. I don't care.
I have no idea. Okay, all right, well, let's find out.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got no problem.
Why are you letting Theresa May thwart your ambition?
Well, these things need to be licensed for use on the mainland. We have assurances from the Prime Minister that they will be made available. There seems to be some hold up in Whitehall. Perhaps it's the Liberal Democrats. Perhaps it's not. I don't know. We await the green light. But the position is a good one in the sense that we have the machines. They are capable of being used. One of them broken is now being fixed. They're capable.
One of them was broken.
I think it was something malfunctioned.
What went wrong with it?
I don't know. It's now fine.
Where are they?
They are. I can't tell.
Why can't you tell me where they are?
I can't, because I think that people would then your natural curiosity, the intrepid journalists of LBC would go out and try and interview one of them.
So that's where we are.
Well, what we'll do? Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, what we'll do on Watercannon is we'll see if we can do it. Anyway.
Yeah, good idea.
All right.
Where should we go?
Natasha in Teddington.
Hello. Today is the last chance that Londoners have to voice their objection to expansion at Heathrow Airport via the public consultation. I wondered if the Mayor's proposal for an estuary airport are dead in the water, and if Davies does recommend Heathrow expansion, what is Boris going to do about it?
I think that it will be... I think we're going round and round in circles in this country, a bit like the planes over London trying to land. I think that all the options now being canvassed by the Davies Commission are bad. It is perfectly obvious from what Heathrow is now saying that they accept there will be huge extra pollution and huge extra costs as a result of trying to build a third runway at Heathrow. They've admitted that they want to pay out, I see, another £450 million in compensation to 160,000 homes. That seems to me to be an admission of guilt and merely a foretaste of the pollution, the noise pollution they propose to inflict on not just on West London, but on the whole of London, parts of London, even South London, even Greenwich, even Lewisham, parts of South London that you don't think will be affected currently. What's will that? Suffer from noise pollution from airplanes. And I'm quite serious. We are sleepwalking into an absolute catastrophe here for this city. And no other city in the world, not even in communist China, would they inflict extra noise pollution of this kind on a great city.
Supporters would say the planes are a lot quieter.
Well, that is complete nonsense. Anybody who has stood in their back garden in West London can testify that they will cause huge amounts of disruption.
So we should go to Gatwick.
And the trouble with Gatwick is that not only will you inflame the anger of the people of West Sussex, and there are lots of people down there who don't want to see huge numbers of planes over their skies, who don't want their lives disrupted. It's a beautiful part of the country, but you won't achieve the kind of hub capacity that you need. Both options are now bad. And so, to get back to Natasha's point, no, I don't think the idea of an estuary solution is remotely dead in the water. It will come back. The ineluctable facts of geography will make us
Davis
at peace again.
The disadvantages don't outweigh the proposed suggested advantages.
This country is going to wake up and realise that you cannot build huge new runways right in the middle of the western suburbs of the city, and it isn't going to work.
But Mr. Mayor, if it was that or nothing, if as the Mayor of London you were presented with,
but it's not that or nothing.
No, but if it was, it is the Davis report, because the Boris Island, well, whatever you want to call it, the estuary airport is off the table.
No,
you know
not.
That.
No, it's not.
Oh, come I think, on, I, Mr. No, it's Mayor, not. There are three runners at the moment. There's Gatwick, and there's two options at Heathrow: an extension and a new runway.
No. Why do you say
it's a fact?
It's not a fact. By the way, because Stansted is also... We thought in TfL that the decision by the Davies Commission to take Stansted off the map was irrational.
Hang on. The people of Sussex can't have planes in their skies, but the people of Essex can.
None of those... All three of those options, so Gatwick, Heathrow and Stansted, are all, in our view, inferior to the long-term solution that we offer in the estuary. What I'm saying is that Heathrow and Gatwick are certainly not the only options.
All right, quick email here. This is from Hugh in Bexley. When are you going to ensure that halal abattoirs in London are outlawed in light of the horrific story in the newspapers today about the abuses of animals at an abattoir in Yorkshire. This is, have you seen the front page of The Independent? This is some pretty horrific images that have also been running on Sky News of a halal abattoir in Thirsk, I think it is. Here we are. Yes, sheep being kicked in the face and head, lifted by their ears, fleeces and legs. A worker bouncing up and down on
well,
the
I think,
neck
you know, all
of a sheep. Staff laughing.
We have laws in this country to prevent people from abusing animals in abattoirs, and very strict laws, very strict legislation. I remember when it all came in, there was a great deal of hoo-ha. Whoever was running that abattoir in Yorkshire should clearly be prosecuted, and that is the way
but
forward. Can I just say something for the benefit of, I think it was Neil in Gatwick. LPG is not banned, Neil. You can drive your LPG van into London, and we will welcome you with open arms. We will simply ask you to pay the congestion charge, because it is no longer as clean by comparison with other vehicles. And that, I'm afraid, is the sad reason.
So he's got to pay his £12 a day.
He's got to pay his congestion charge if he wants to drive through the central zone.
Right. I think that was in part.
They have not been
making
banned.
No,
he claimed that they've been banned, which slightly puzzled me.
Yeah. Okay. So, do you agree with halal slaughter? Lastly, on the other story, the email from...
Well, I think, you know, once you get into...
Hugh in Bexley.
Once you get into banning types of ritually approved or religious slaughter, you get into some very, very deep and difficult waters. And, you know, what source for the goose has got to be source for the gander, so to speak. I don't know how you ritually slaughter a goose. Or indeed a gander. Mm. But it's got to be done in the same way.
Right.
That's the point.
Okay. So you're for it. All right. Okay. We move on to another caller. Where do we go?
Can we get a Maureen in Waterloo?
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, Maureen.
I'd like to ask you why TfL are closing ticket offices in order to save money, and yet spending £30 million on a garden bridge on the South Bank, also £30 million coming from the public purse, in order to build this bridge, which we don't need. We've got umpteen bridges along the South Bank. We've got more parks and spaces in London than anywhere.
Yeah. Well,
so,
Maureen...
It's such a disgrace when we need social housing that £60 million is going towards this bridge that is absolutely unnecessary.
Well, the polls
are against it. Also, I think the law courts are against it. Many people are against it.
Well, I understand that. I understand your feelings, Maureen. Do you live in an area affected by the landfall of the Garden Bridge?
Yeah, I live in very close by. I can see the river from where I live.
Well, obviously, there are some people in that neighbourhood who do worry about it. All I can say is it will be a fantastic addition to London.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.